Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainsley, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Jingong Huang. Jingong joined the School of Economics as an assistant professor in 2018 after receiving his doctorate from the University of Melbourne.
Jingong's research explores the intersection of macroeconomics, finance, and industrial organization with specialism in economic growth. His publications have appeared in the Journal of Corporate Finance, Energy Economics, and the Journal of Financial Markets.
In 2023, together with collaborators Chunfei Wenga and Matthew Greenwood Nimmo, Jingong published the article, The Effect of Clean Energy Investment on CO2 Emissions, Insights from a Spatial Durban Model, in the journal Energy Economics, in which he argues that ad hoc policies to promote clean energy investment may be ineffective at lessening global emissions, and that a coordinated international policy framework is required to prevent jurisdiction shopping by polluters.
I love that term, jurisdiction shopping. Yeah, it's very. There's lots of super cool terms in this article I found, actually.
No, I agree with you. I also actually liked the kind of ad hoc policies, in essence, as well. You know, kind of ad hoc policies, jurisdiction shopping.
Spatial dependence.
We could keep on going.
We will keep going.
Okay. But overall, Derek, I found this article particularly interesting. As regards, it was actually maybe slightly more optimistic than other articles I've read about kind of pollution and green economics and all of this, because it did basically suggest that countries are interested in doing things about these problems. They are interested in clean energy. The problem more seemed to be that there isn't a sort of regional coordinated approach.
Global.
Well, I'd go with more regional, okay. Because actually in the article, Jingong talks more about kind of sort of countries that are sort of spatially connected. And in essence, you have kind of one country that's in investing in sort of green infrastructure and lessening pollution. But instead, actually, this just ends up being kind of outsourced to the countries that it has a close relationship with, or it's very much kind of near to in many ways. And to me, that spoke to kind of regionalism. So not sort of global, not sort of national or domestic, but kind of regional in this sense. And it also kind of coalesced with my own understanding here, because just about every single field right now, whether it's kind of media and comms, for instance, or even sort of literature or things, seems now to be invested in and very much connected to this notion of regionalism in this way. You know, so even if it's sort of pollution and green energy, or it's more sort of creativity, it all seemed to be, actually, we need to think of things not necessarily globally, not necessarily nationally, but actually more kind of regionally. And this adheres to politics too, where we see things like the rise of ASEAN, I was thinking of, or China's Belt and Road, all of
and
these
yet
kind
there
of
are
connections.
Counter issues.
Oh, here he goes, countering me.
I'm not countering you. I'm saying that there are real problems.
You're not
with,
countering me.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's a first.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know. But you know, with the rise of a kind of Trumpism, you've got actually individual nations that are trying to derail processes like this, which I'm very interested in getting an expert to weigh in on, which is why we've invited
you. We actually have an expert here. Yeah, so we should stop talking. Welcome, Jingong. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of your paper, please?
Thank you very much for inviting me to join this podcast.
Thank you for
it's
coming.
It's a great honor.
Well, it's a great paper, so thank you for sharing.
Thank you
that.
Very much for the interest in my paper. So actually, I think Mary has come up with a very good summary of my paper.
That's my job. What I do.
Yeah,
that's why I'm here.
Great that you guys are interested in the paper and the language of the paper is easy to understand from the perspective of outsiders. at least I'm not an expert economist, I think.
I did feel that when I read it. The first thing I looked at was, oh my goodness, there's so much math here. So many numbers and so many graphs.
Formula.
But actually, it is very accessible. It's much more accessible than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I guess, the first message we would like to deliver to not just audience inside economics, but also the general policymakers. Because in this paper, what we're trying to do is to think about the issue series. What's the issue here? We're trying to think about the impact of clean energy investment on carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, back 10 years ago, this is an extremely hot issue when the world order is still under sensible leadership compared to what happened nowadays.
I wouldn't go that far. Sensible leadership is few and far between, but not insane.
Fine, I agree with you. But yeah, it's I think it's a simple, but it's a very important question. We're trying to investigate the impact of, say, if you put money into the clean energy sector, what's your benefit from the perspective of a country? But also, we would like to go a little bit beyond that to think about the potential spillover effect. Because when you talk about the climate issue, specifically, when you talk about the carbon emissions, it's not really your country's issue. Because, for example, in this paper, we demonstrate that if you reduce carbon emission, of course, it would be beneficial to your country, right? But it also has a two-way spillover effect to other countries. It means that if you increase your investment in clean energy, you will reduce carbon emission. But because carbon emission cannot be contained in your country, you actually do others a favor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is what we call the free rider. Right?
Yeah, that's an interesting term as well. Free riding on the whole carbon reduction.
So this is one of the spillover effect that I think people need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And the second spillover effect is more that the outsourcing. So to some extent, from the perspective of the, especially from the policymaker, sometimes we may think it's very easy. The decision to invest in clean energy is just straightforward.
Mm.
There's tons of benefit. Why not? Let's invest in clean energy investment. Let's reduce our carbon emission. Well, that's make our world better, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then the issue is that there's a substitution effect here, because if you cut the, if you increase the investment in clean energy at the expenses of dirty energy investment, it means that you actually cut the total production of your energy, and most of the time, a reduction in the total carbon emission means that you have to reduce your production.
Okay.
All right. So sometimes there's a substitution effect here.
Can we just pause for a moment and can you define for us what is clean energy and what is dirty energy?
So in this paper specifically, we define clean energy as renewable energy. For example, the solar panel, the wind, the heating, this kind of renewable energy, which would not typically generate the carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. So hydroelectric counts in there as well? Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So anything that doesn't create carbon emissions.
Yeah, yeah, because carbon emissions is basically the dependent variable in our regression or for our analysis. So any other energy that can potentially generate carbon emission would be classified as dirty energy.
So mostly fossil fuel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Most fossil fuel. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So this second effect, when policymakers make a decision to, say, promote clean energy investment by, say, passing laws that increase subsidy or punish the dirty investment, these are two, I would say, most commonly seen ways to increase clean energy investment. Then from the perspective of industries or even a disaggregate level to firms, they have an incentive to reallocate their production from countries where there's a stronger or stringent, more stringent environmental protection to countries that this is the case. So that this is what we call the carbon leakage effect. Mm-hmm. It's possible that, well, for the benefit of your country, you pass laws to protect the environment, but that will cause problems to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something like a negative spillover effect to your neighboring countries if your neighboring countries actually receive the reduced carbon emission.
Could you give a real world example of that?
Yeah, I think a typical example is actually China and ASEAN countries. you know that China is actually a very active player in the global war in terms of reducing the carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. The presidency has promised that up to, I think, 2050, we would reach the neutrality of carbon emission.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to achieve this goal, actually, the central government imposed a lot of restrictions in especially the heavy polluting industries. They're trying to restrict the quota in terms of carbon emission. They also try to reduce the material productions in these industries. So what's the solution? The solution is that some of the companies try to outsource most of their heavy polluting activities to the ASEAN countries. So I think this is, I guess, a recent example that I can come up with.
One really interesting effect that you talk about, which it hadn't occurred to me either, is that by investing in green energies and clean energy, effectively, in many cases, it drives down the price of dirty energy.
Yeah.
So one of the side effects is by pursuing clean energy, there's less demand on the dirty energy. And so that then becomes cheaper, incentivizing its use in the areas where it hasn't been controlled.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the complexity of the economic world, because we are living in the jargon of economists, the general equilibrium effect. So what's the general equilibrium effect? The general equilibrium effect is typically this kind of substitution effect that you may not expect in the first place when you're trying to impose some policies. Just as what Derry mentioned, the demand for different type of energies are actually substitutable. To some extent, while increase of the demand for one thing may actually reduce the demand for the other thing and vice versa. And in this case, if we invest more on clean energy, and that could potentially reduce the demand for the dirty energy and subsequently reduce the prices. But then the general equilibrium effect kicks in. You see that when the price of stuff goes down, the demand actually goes up. This is the general equilibrium effect. This is the counterbalancing effect that's very commonly seen in economics. Yeah.
I was amazed by this study in terms of its breadth. So you look at 73 different countries that you could get data on. The one thing that I was curious about is, was this just because the data was available for these countries, or were they deliberately chosen, or were there some that you wanted to include but couldn't, for example?
It's actually a data issue. We're trying to include as many countries as possible, because this is a study about the regional spillover effect. Of course, if it's possible, we would be happy to include every single country in the world.
Right.
But instead, because carbon emission, we need data on carbon emissions, and not every single country has the capacity to store the data about carbon, because you need a monitor to detect,
or the desired order, exactly. Presumably.
So, most of the countries that we have data are countries that have a degree of openness. Because when you're trying to trade with each other, you need to have your information available, for example, to the World Bank or WTO, right? So that they will be able to monitor this process. And that's why we pick up this 73 countries, I think. We're trying to get as many countries as possible.
And it's super difficult. I was amazed by trying to wrap my head around the varying kinds of data. Because you do mention Australia for one, and Australia is unique in that it doesn't have any land borders.
Yeah, exactly.
And the idea of spillover from Australia to some other country is much more tenuous than ones in Europe that are closely packed together and share land borders and the like.
Yeah.
So maybe can you talk us through some of these? Because you did, I think, quite a good job of trying to control these issues, but it does raise some questions.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in this paper, we have two kinds of measures in terms of distance. One is the geographical distance that you just mentioned. If two countries are close to each other, of course, it would be easy for one country's policy to impact another country, right? And the other type of distance is what we call the economic distance. For example, you mentioned about Australia. Australia actually is a very close trading partner with China.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So anything that happened in China would have a spillover effect to Australia through their trading relationship. They trade a lot of goods and services.
Right.
So that's the hidden mechanism that play a role here.
I was quite curious about that because one of the findings was that actually, now correct me if I'm wrong, I need to double check this, but that the economic ties wasn't an important variable. Is that right?
Not really. The way we try to take into account the economic ties is to use that as a factor to weight the geographic distance. So in our baseline analysis, we simply use the geographic distance as a measurement in terms of how close each countries are.
Ah,
okay.
Right? So country pairs, if they are geographically close to each other, then mm-hmm. they would have a higher weights. All right? On the other hand, we fully appreciate that the world is not about whether we are close enough to each other, but also about the economic connections, right? And that's why we twist the weight by adding this element of openness, trade openness, all right?
Which is more important there, is it?
Yeah, it's definitely more important given the advancement of technology, right?
Okay.
Now it becomes very easy for countries to export, to import, even in the service sector, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
I found that fascinating. So that actually for me was eye-opening, that the idea that the quote here is, the effect of trade openness on carbon emissions is negative, which is consistent with the view that trade can bring advanced technology into an economy, improving energy efficiency and mitigating emissions.
Mm. Yeah.
So that was a really fascinating finding. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? Because we think about shipping and trade as itself creating quite a carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is this finding that it actually mitigates that or?
Not really, but so we are talking about two different things here. One is the carbon emissions generated by traveling, by shipping,
right?
Shipping physical goods to other countries. Mm-hmm. But in this paper, it's more about the potential substitution effect of productivity or production itself.
So is that geographically bound? So we're not actually talking about the carbon emissions of shipping.
Yeah, that's basically not counted by this study. But correct me if I'm wrong. From my understanding, I think the carbon emission generated by traveling, by this shipping of goods and services is a small proportion of the total carbon emissions.
I can't correct you because I have no idea. I trust you as an expert in the area to know much, much more than I do.
That's never stopped you from criticizing me.
I'm sorry, Mary.
From reading the paper myself, one thing that interested me and that I was quite surprised about, but also very pleased to see, is that there is actually a lot of legislation, all right? Mm-hmm. There is actually a lot of legislation that exists about cutting greenhouse gases and carbon emissions and all of that. And while that's a good thing, it seemed to be that this is just too easily bypassed, that there's too much going on kind of internationally that stops these from being effective? And you particularly talked about the outsourcing of pollution from one country to another as well. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how those have been rendered ineffectual by the economic circumstances?
Yeah, so this is, I've been termed as the carbon leakage effect in our paper. So again, the idea is very simple. As I said, if you say, for example, in China, if we pass a law that trying to increase the protection for environment, then that actually create, let me slow down slightly here, that actually increase the cost of production for firms in the traditional industry. Right.
Why hasn't this been accounted for then? Is it just because people making these laws are not economists?
To some extent, I believe.
But the job of the government is to help to control these things, right?
Yeah. So. But if you take a look at what happened in the US, they passed a lot of
about
bizarre
up and down. Yeah.
I'm not sure whether they. The policymakers there are aware of the spillover effect to the financial markets when they talk about these their initiative in terms of tariffs. But that's really
let's not go into that.
Yeah, that's really out of our topic.
But I love the term that you use, pollution havens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in a way, we're incentivizing certain places with. Lesser developed economies, let's say, or lesser environmental protection, lesser regulation, to become areas in which there's almost a pollution free-for-all, right?
Yeah, but this is also a self-selection in the sense that the country that becomes pollution haven, they make a trade-off between protection of the environment and growing their economy. Right. So when they think that the potential marginal benefits of receiving this polluting industries from other countries is going to outweigh at least the short run marginal cost of polluting the environment, then this sounds like the first best choice for them as well.
Well, first wave industrialization is almost always polluting.
Yeah, exactly. You see, if you see what happened in the history, the heavy polluting industry has been passed down from the developed countries to the these developed countries, and this trend just never stop, right? In the past, is China, is Korea, is Japan. When they become developed countries, a relative developed country, they pass the production chain to the lower income countries.
Seems so so counterproductive. I mean, it's the idea you can't nationalize air. You know, if the country next door to you is polluted, you also breathe that in.
Yeah, exactly.
So it almost, I'm a bit kind of like, is this the point in our development where we have become so kind of fixated into these kind of national boundaries that we now think that air and water does not actually pass through them?
I think it's beyond national boundaries as well, though, right? Because when I was reading through this, I thought it was really interesting. And as Mary started the conversation by talking about regionalism,
exactly.
Even in, you know, so China is a highly diverse country, and there are areas of China which are more heavily industrialized, less populated, and then there are more heavily populated and less heavy industry, perhaps. And so you know, even within national boundaries, you have this kind of trade-off, right?
Yeah, exactly. There are tons of research that focus on similar issues within China, because China alone is like a combination of countries in Europe in terms of population scale, in terms of land size, right?
Yeah.
And Derek made a very good point in the sense that there's substantial heterogeneity across different provinces in China, and different provinces face very different problems. And that's partially caused by different industry structure, by different economic structures.
Different resources available,
et cetera. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I would say the issues within China is almost identical to the issues across countries in the greater Asian area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was thinking too, so I come from a northern country, right? So one of the major issues in Canada, of course, is winter has demands on heating that simply aren't demands in, you know, the southern U.S. or, you know, even... You know, the differences between Beijing and Ningbo are extremely different in terms of, you know, how you get through the weather. So I was curious about this because just things like, you know, how do we control for different demands from other facets of the geography maybe?
That's always a big issue for economies. We try our best to control all kinds of confounding factors so that, to make sure our results are not driven by some unknown variables, unknown factors. But I have to admit that there's a limit about how much we can do, in this kind of empirical analysis. But typically, I think we pick up important factors. For example, in our analysis, we control for the size of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So your GDP measure, GDP per capita, we rotate the measures, trying to make our results robust. And we also trying to control, say, the connection of a country with the rest of the world in terms of how much export-import that you have done and the proportion of export-import in terms of the GDP.
Mm.
Because for countries that U.S., you may be surprised to see that their proportion of export and import measured in terms of GDP is actually quite small.
Really?
This is not because... U.S. is not a major player in the global trading system, but instead, this is just because they are so huge in terms of their economic scale. They do a lot of domestic production, a lot of domestic consumption. So in terms of numbers, in terms of the relative numbers, so export and import is not a substantial chunk of their GDP.
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah, so that's how you can get away with playing these tariff games?
To some extent, yes.
Sorry, we always get back to that. It's the kind of...
it's the theme right
the present
now.
Day world issues creep in on us.
Well, by the time this comes out, what on earth will be happening? Yeah, everything we had to do.
Who knows exactly? I have one kind of interesting question, I think it's interesting anyway, is you use a reference from Jevons in 1866 talking about the coal question. And I was fascinated by, you know, on one hand, how dated that reference was, but also obviously it's key to some of the points that you're trying to make. So how environmental or how far back does this kind of awareness stretch?
Well, I guess I'm not an expert to answer this question.
Given my
age and my access to the literature,
just one thing to say though. I have actually seen this more and more. And particularly in economics papers.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, this use of older references, particularly around the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of almost a circular kind of going back to the same kind of issues, I think, that were being addressed economically at that time. Because I think there are a lot of parallels between our two situations now as regards things like rapid economic growth, all the rest of it, crises at the same time, global movement of resources as well. So I have seen this quite a lot before.
Oh, exactly. I wouldn't expect you pay so close attention to that.
We're careful readings, Jingang.
I think it's also my field in media studies is also kind of doing this as well, because you're seeing this sort of rapid change of the media industries in the same way you were seeing them in the late 19th century at the same time. So there's actually wider research around this that is still relevant in a sort of theoretical sense often.
Yeah.
And an empirical sense.
So I think going back to Derek's question, actually, economists have been aware of this issue for quite a long time. At least, I think, back to 15 years ago, 40 years ago, to be more precise, people start to build what we call general equilibrium model in environmental sense. So we're trying to incorporate the potential spillover effect of production into our environments. So trying to measure the social welfare in our terminology and the social costs, you know, because in the good old days, we don't have to worry about the externality of our production. In the sense that if you produce something, so this is for your private interest, because economic emphasizes on the incentive to do basically everything in our world. For example, if you are running a company, well, the only thing that you need to worry about is to make money. So we don't have to worry about whether the stuff you produce will be somehow produce a negative effect on our environments.
Yeah, people right. downstream from you don't count, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, Jingong, while I began this saying I found this paper quite optimistic, now we're getting quite pessimistic.
No, this is the past.
This is the past.
Really?
Looking at the future, we're being better neighbors now.
Do we have any... that was actually going to be my next question, was do you have any examples of this progress? Because you of course, conclude as part of the papers... that this issue around global emissions can't be solved by national policymakers alone. Okay, yeah. So that's sort of one of your main conclusions of the paper. So do we see any actual movement in that direction where there is global or regional cooperation here?
Well, I think this is not the best timing for us to to think about an answer to this question, given that this is a substantial disturbance from, you know, the world leader who trying to disrupt all of the old orders in our world. It used to be the case that US is really leading the paths in terms of technology, in terms of investment. Of course, European play a substantial role as well. And actually, China is very active participants.
Electric vehicles are incredible.
Yeah, exactly. But now, I think these kind of issues has been squeezed out of discussion these days, particularly because Trump take the power in the White House, and people start to switch your attention to, you know, the trade war, something like that. So,
but also internal policy, the idea of the whole drill, baby, drill, somehow fossil fuels are better sources of energy. Coal mining, these type of things.
But are we placing too much emphasis on America here? Just because we really like criticizing Trump, understandably so. But the rest of the world plays its part too.
Sure. I totally agree. And I hope that maybe the Europe and China can join together, particularly in this issue, because they have collaborations before, but just get disrupted by some other geopolitical issues. So I think it's actually a time for our world to have new leaders in this dimension.
Well, one really optimistic thing here that near the end of your paper that you say is that high-income countries will often have the greater ability to fund ambitious clean energy projects and to meet the potentially large initial and or ongoing costs associated with exploiting knowledge spillovers. And the one thing China is amazing at is giant projects, right? I mean, historically, contemporarily, doing big things as a collective is a specialty here. So is that a positive spin, maybe?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think this is part of the Chinese economy is called the institutional advantage. There's a very strong central government in China, which means that if the central government make a decision to push something for what, then there's always a way for what. I think a place where maybe Chinese government can collaborate with, say, the ASEAN countries, because we are actually in the same boat to some extent. We share similar cultures to some extent, especially if you think about Vietnam, Malaysia, there's a substantial immigrants from China. So cultures are very similar. And so we can understand the hidden sort of message through communication. I always found that maybe sometimes when the Chinese government communicates with, say, the US government or some Western governments that have different language, sometimes there might be misunderstanding when we talk, you know.
So well, let's not get into linguistics in this particular talk here.
Yeah,
but I fully agree with you that even if you have interpreters, that doesn't mean that you have a kind of cultural understanding or you understand the implicatures of what you're saying.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. Now, one question about this paper then. Have you had any criticism of it? Has anyone come up and said, no, your model is flawed, or has anyone levied any criticism against it?
Well, at least for referees, we have two referees for this paper.
Oh, those referees. Always those referees.
Yeah, they are pretty happy with the methodological side. Because it's a very standard method. It's not that we come up with a new methodology. We just follow literature and trying to make our analysis as clean as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So referee has no issues with the model part, and they just think that we can extend our analysis to more countries if it's possible, because we rely on this special spillover discussion to strengthen the arguments in our paper.
It would be interesting because almost all of these are middle and high income countries, right?
Yeah. So
for good reason, because data might not be available.
That's the main reason. And it would be great for in the future if we can also include some really low income countries because they are more passive in terms of sending out their message to the world, right?
So is that your plan for the future?
Yeah. We plan to do, if possible, and if we have the funding to buy, because it's very costly. It's pricey to get the data. It's not free. If we get the funding, we can extend the data set to include more countries.
And do you have to ever go on the ground? So some of these countries might not have publicly available data.
But there are some private companies that collect data, but it's always pricey. You know? They collect the data for some reason.
Well, maybe
our
university management or our funding bodies might be listening to this podcast. We have a very good way for you to funnel money.
We can live in hope. Jingong, thank you very much for joining us in the studio and for sharing your paper. And we wish you all the best in
the
future.
It's a great pleasure to be here talking with you guys.
It's a great paper and I think a really important area to look at. So thank you for the work there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.